contracts.
So what we're going to do today, we're going to talk about the interpretation of contracts, and then we're going to talk about contract remedy for the breach. Briefly, when you guys, and I'll have a slide on this, when one or both parties don't perform as they promise. So what we want to talk about, when you do contracts, what's really important is for there to be rules about how to understand and how to interpret contracts. So you got to figure out when somebody else, when there's this dispute between the parties, there's going to be a third party that's going to be reading the agreement. That may be a judge, maybe the jury listening to the story, or maybe an arbitration. So it's important to understand how we interpret them and how we look at things. So the first thing we're going to talk about, we talked about, and there's a lot of, one of the things I try to do in the beginning, especially for the first part of the semester, a lot of these terms are brand new to you, and I've been doing this for 35 years, longer than that. So this is all really easy for me. And that's when I rewritten my exam many times because it's really simple for me, but you guys don't know this. So I have to get it to some like beginner level. I have to remember back when I first started law school. So there's a lot of repetition. We talked about expression implied. Let's talk about that last week a little bit. So we're going to go into a little bit more. So express, we have express and implied terms within the contract. You know, you have your express contract, which could be oral or written, and then we have the implied contract and everything else. But here, now we're within the contract itself. Now, it could be oral, but for purposes of today and for going on, most of the time when I'm going to refer to contract, hopefully what we're talking about is a written agreement. My recommendation to you is you're a lawyer, even though none of you have hired me, I will be your lawyer for the semester, and then I also offer this, some of your former classmates have taken me up on this. If you have questions, whether it's now, whether it's later in the future, call me in 10 years, you want to call me and say, hey, Mike, I got a question about this, I won't charge you for any of that stuff. If I take you out of the client, we'll do that, but I will be your lawyer, and you can answer questions, so I'll help you out with a little things that work the way. But so for purposes of this, I want you guys all, whenever you do anything in the profession when you get out there, make sure there's a written agreement. Because if it's oral, he said, she said, nobody knows what exactly said, what, or what. So if it's in writing, you're in a good place. But when we're in a written contract, there are some things that may not be clear or may not be completely there. You think about a contract, and when we get to the B101, we're going to see that's the AIA contract for the owner architect agreement. You're going to see the B101 is about 28, 30 pages or around there. And the A201, which is the owner contractor agreement, with the owner architect, the owner contractor agreement, that was like 47 pages long. It's all in like 10.5. There's a ton of words in there, there's a ton of stuff. And neither of those contracts are remotely complete because you can't put everything down. So you have to have both express and implied terms. So the express terms are actually spelled out, either writing or oral. So it's expressly stated. I will do this if you do that. You've written it down, you've communicated it to each other. It's an express term, it's black and white. Implied terms, however, are part of the agreement, but they are not necessarily discussed or communicated. So you're maybe into an architectural agreement where you're an architect and I'm the owner, and I say I'll pay $10,000 if you design for me my backyard addition, and that's expressed. What's not expressed is if it's going to take 3 months, you're likely going to be billing me on a monthly basis. Now, hopefully your contract will say that, but when I get a bill, I should be paid if it's not expressed. It's implied. Because that's what happens to me. That's what happens just in general business and everything else. So there's certain things that are implied. So we talk about commonly implied terms in a construction contract. Neither party will hinder the other from performing the contract. That means, like in construction, if I'm an owner and I got a contractor on the field and they're doing something, I'm not going to go out as the owner and tell them they need to do something different. That's not my job. I'm not going to hinder the other party from doing the job. If you're the architect and I'm the owner and I come in, I'm going to say, no, you don't design using this type of program. I mean, you may set that up originally as an express term, and a lot of times I actually have some of that, those things in my agreements about certain types of software you might use, but you are not going to tell the other person what to do. Same thing is the contractor, and I have my across the street neighbor, this happened to him and their family. The contractor shouldn't restrict the owner from coming on a project site. They own the land, they're paying for the project site. As long as the owner's following the safety provisions of the site, they should be able to come on and see what's happening. The reason why I mentioned my neighbor is he had a contractor building the house for them. It's right across the street from us. And there was lots of problems that over the years, as I've seen, like they had to rip off their floors, they had to do a heating system and everything else. And I was just talking to him as a neighbor, but he knows I'm a construction lawyer. And he asked me, he's like, you know, some of this stuff I might have picked up on, but he wouldn't let me ever come on the project site. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, every time I wanted to come see the project, he wouldn't let me come on. He goes, I never saw the house until it was finished. And I'm like, well, that's hindering. In implied term in construction contracts, if I'm paying for it, I own it, it's implied that I'm not going to hinder it. If somebody wants to come on site, they come on site. So, another one here. The construction will be performed in a good and workmanlike manner. You don't want your contractor to do crappy work. So, like, I'm not hiring you to do bad work, I'm hiring you to do the good work. Now, you're going to see when we get into the A201, there's a provision, because that's the construction contract, called warranty. I warrant that I'm actually in the language in there. It says, I warrant that the work will be done in a good and workmanlike manner. So written contracts, and then we'll get into more as we talk a little bit more about the AIA contract or any contract, but they fill in the gaps when you find out that there's too many implied terms that people didn't understand, it's better to write them down. But it's really common in construction that the contractor is going to perform in a good workmanlike manner. Or the architect will perform duties in accordance with their appropriate standard of care. Standard of care is something you hear me talk about for the whole semester. And we'll get there, but I'll just give you a preview of it so you don't have to remember for this lecture. But standard of care is that the architect will perform in accordance with what a normal architect performing the same type of work in the same location. You don't have to be a super architect, but you have to perform as an architect that your peers are doing. For a house, if you're developing a house. For a hospital, if you're developing a hospital. So that's your standard of care. It changes on the project, it changes in the location, but that's what's expected. If I hire you to design me a hospital, I expect that the architects that are working on that project have experience in designing a hospital. That's an implied term if it's not written in here. So those are your kind of examples you'll see over from time to time. Especially if it's an oral agreement, which you really don't want to do, but if there's an oral agreement, all those will be implied. Question? Yes and no. So you're going to find certain things that are relative to regional design that's going to be depicted by what's in the area. If you're designing something in the Chicago area, let's say you're doing the high rise. So, and you guys, I don't know how much you guys, how many people have an undergraduate in architecture. I know that the master's program here is not about structural mechanics and some of the other courses, but anybody that took courses in undergrad about structure and everything else. One of the things you can learn when you design a high rise is actually wind shear is more than the grass. That's one of the things you have to design for. But if you're designing a house, you need to make sure that there's snow loads. If I'm designing in Texas or I'm designing in Arizona, I don't need to worry about what the common snow load might be. If you're designing in California, you have to know about earthquakes. So there is regional, but it's not necessarily the architect in that area per se for certain things. There's going to be geographical things of snow, wind, nature that's going to drive what is standard of care for that area. It just so happens that all your peers are going to be in that area that are going to be working in that. So that's why the normal architect doing the similar performance, similar project in a similar area. So they kind of keep it like that. So, any questions?
Sorry.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You mentioned that you mentioned that you're designing a hospital, so it's like program-specific
in the position? Well, I mean, if you're going to have somebody that, whether it's program or the project, like a good owner, if they're going to be building a hospital, are going to go out and they're going to interview a bunch of architects to make sure they get some of the specialized in their area so they get the best product. But if the team has one person that had done hospitals, and then they have everybody else that was, you know, had done strip mall, and something goes wrong, then maybe they weren't performing to the standard of care. Because the architect is being retained to design a hospital. And that includes everything from clean rooms to air circulation to regular purpose social circulation, lots of things that have to come into the hospital. Because I worked on actually the hospital over here, the Rush Hospital, I worked on the butterfly one. There's lots of stuff that the average residential architect just wouldn't know. So you have to hold those architectural standard of care of that type of project. You know, nuclear reactor, or a high-rise, or even a regular house, whatever you might need. So it is, whether you want to call it program-related, or what they're being routine for, however you want to look at it, that is an element that comes into it. Okay. So, the goal, when we're looking at this, interpreting context, because remember, this is all about how we interpret what's in the language, what the agreement was, the meaning of the mind. The goal is that the trier of fact looks to determine actual bargain. Now, I think I mentioned this last week, but I'll say it again. We have two things in the law. We have the trier of fact, and we have the trier of law. Now, there's different ways that if a case goes to court or to arbitration, there are different ways that the facts and the law will be interpreted. If you have the standard judge and jury, the jury is responsible as the trier of facts. They are to listen to the facts, and they are to decide what the bargain is. The judge, who is the judge and jury, is just the trier of law. That means that there's an evidentiary question of how the evidence comes in. Hearsay, Your Honor, whatever it might be. The judge will make the ruling on legally whether that information can come in. When you hear objection, Your Honor, all these other stuff. But that's what the judge will be. The judge will not decide the facts. There are some gray lines in that, but we don't have to worry about it. But that's the basic of it. If it's a bench trial just means there's no jury, just the judge is handling it. The judge is both the trier of fact and the trier of law. And then if it's an arbitration, again, the panels for the arbitration will be the trier of fact and the trier of law. So there's times when they're together, there's times when they're split. But ultimately, whoever is the trier of fact, jury or judge or arbitration panel, their job is to listen to both sides and say, oh, this is what the bargain was. And listening to both sides will also include reading the contract. Listening to other people's understanding what the contract meant. There's this thing called parole evidence. You don't have to worry about it. It's, again, 10 levels down into the legal evidence area. We're not taking an evidence class, we're taking an instructional class. But that's their job. I want to figure out what the bargain was. The court, the arbitrator, also, when you're looking at what we do with contracts, they will not rewrite the contract. If the words say X, the judge and the arbitration panel, because they're dealing with the law, say the law says it's X. And X may have, there may be a statute, there may be common law that the judge will say to the jury, if you find this from the set of facts, the language in the contract by law means you must award that way. That's jury instructions and everything else. So there's going to be statement in the contract that the judge will tell the jury if you find A or B, you must find X or Y. You must award whatever the questions might be. And those are all that come into jury questions. So, but that's how we interpret these contracts, the first part. Try to fact, benefit of the bargain, what's the bargain? And the court arbitration is what's going to be, we're not rewriting that. Whatever it says is what it says. We're not going to create something that's not on paper. First level analysis is also part of it. We want to look at the objective language of the contract. And that kind of falls into this concept of not rewriting. Objective, not subjective. So objective is what you see. Clear and unambiguous language is always enforced as it is. You are going to design me a 3-bedroom, 3-bath house. I will pay you $50,000 for that. Those are clear and express terms. If I don't pay the full $50,000, I'm in breach. If you design me a 3-bedroom, 4-bath house, technically you're in breach if you didn't have the authorization to do that, and I don't have to pay you for some of the additional design time. So there's those that clear and unambiguous language is always enforced as written. We're not going to change that. No explanations or clarifications of the language is permitted. Now, I said the judge or the jury may hear both sides listening, trying to say what I thought it meant. And there's some flexibility in this, that's when I get into this whole concept of plural evidence. But really what the judge will tell the jury, or if it's the judge themselves, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if you see an express term, that party may thought said it, they thought it means this, and that party said they thought it means that, you must objectively tell the court in your ruling what the written, clear, and ambiguous language is. We're not going to allow you guys to be swayed by all I said. You thought it meant this, or they told me something else. And the reason why this comes up is you can have negotiations back and forth. I say I'll pay you 40. You say you want 60. I say I'll pay you 45. There's this back and forth. And at some point in time, we come to an agreement and we write it down. But maybe not everything was clear in that discussion. Maybe at some point you said, well, I'll do it for 50, but you have to pay me in advance. Or there's all these other things that may factor in, but when it turns out when they wrote the contract, it's just set up paying $50,000 on a monthly basis. It didn't say payment in advance. It didn't have all the terms that were discussed over the table. And then when you turn out and you say, well, they didn't pay me the money I wanted in advance, the jury can only look at the clear and ambiguous language. They're going to hear testimony. Well, we talked about this. We talked about giving payment in advance, but it never made it to the contract. So we can't listen to the explanation. We have to listen to the clear and ambiguous language. So, and the last one, why do we do this process of analysis? And if you remember, from the very first day, the whole part about the law, or one of the biggest parts about the law, is predicting future, the predictability of what's going to happen. So if we wrote something down, that's what should be happening. And so we want to make sure that if there's a problem, we have to figure out how do we make sure that the parties, when they agree, and whether they understand these rules. Most people that enter into a contract have never taken a class like this, never taken a legal class, so they don't understand how terms are written, how terms are interpreted, how contracts are interpreted. But the law can only do what they do. So when we do this analysis, we have to create rules and steps. So everybody, when we get to court, follows the same rules. Simple example is, if you ever see a contract, well, you'll see a contract when you get to B101. Any term that's capitalized, like you're reading it and it says, the parties to this agreement, and the A is capitalized in the middle of it, that term is what's called a defined term. And somewhere else in that document, it says, the agreement means blah, blah, blah. So you get all these defined terms. So when you are a judge or jury or a lawyer interpreting a contract, and you see a capitalized term, you know that means somewhere it has a definition. There's a thing, has anybody here heard the term instruments of service? So you'll hear that a lot in this class. In the owner-architect agreement, there's a paragraph that talks about intellectual property. You don't have to write this down, I'll just give you a little bit of information. We'll write it down later, we'll talk about it a few moments. Just hear it, and then I'll show it to you in a couple weeks. There's a paragraph that talks about copyrights. And that's one of the lifeblood of an architect. I always emphasize, hold on to your copyrights. Owners want to keep the building, they want to keep the site. Hold on to it. I'll give you permission to teach you how to do that. But it talks about what falls under that copyright. A lot of people just think it's drawings. You know, because that's what you think about. Drawings. But it's specifications. It's an action of method. It's paint. It's a model. It's your CAD stuff. Anything that you create is something that you have a copyright for, and you own that. Anything that's created for building that building, and you are designing that building. And so when you have the paragraph, it's like, and you'll see when we get this, this, and 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 this. If you had to repeat that every single time you wanted to talk about it, your contract would be really, really long. So it says all these 20 different things, and then it says, known as instruments of service. So every time it says instruments of service, with the I and the F capitalized, you know it goes back to the paragraph. So that's something that we do that. When a judge and jury looks at the contract and they want to figure something out, they know how to do this now. Everybody knows that, on the legal side, everybody knows that a capitalized term is a defined term. So, and part of also is, and there's going to be language you'll see in contracts that talk about priority, specific over general, and written over oral, and all of those stuff. But the whole point of trying to figure out why we do this is to resolve the conflict between Party A and Party B. Questions?
Yes, sir.
So, how do we resolve these inconsistencies and contradictions? Because that's basically what happens when there's a breach. Some parties, well, not always, sometimes they just do crappy work and they know they shouldn't have done crappy work and that's a breach. But there's often one of the reasons why there's a breach of contract is because party A thought about this and party B wanted that about that. And they didn't sync. Or maybe there's a situation where there's a paragraph, if you think about it, like as I said, the A201 is 40 some pages long in 10.5. There's a lot of words in there. Sometimes a paragraph on page 10 isn't consistent with a paragraph on page 37. So how do we resolve that? So that's what we're going to talk about. Again, more rules to understand in context. First, you want to determine whether there is an actual contradiction or inconsistency. Some things may seem to be inconsistent and contradictory, but they may not. So, word of other words, contradictory. Is there a specific inconsistency? And you have to read the contrast as a whole. Everything is under, sometimes I'll do this, the four corners, I'll make a little square like that. You look at everything within the four corners of the contract, and everything in the whole is going to be what the contract is read as. So maybe there's these two provisions on page 10 and page 37 at the original part where you look at them seem inconsistent. But then maybe you read a whole bunch of the stuff in the middle, and they become more consistent. So you need to find out truly if there's an inconsistency. That's one of the rules you need to put in. And then, is there an interpretation? Is there a contract rule or judicial rule that would allow the terms to be reached as consistent? So there's going to be an interpretation rule when we talk about express and implied. That's an interpretation. A judicial rule. A judicial rule, as I gave you the example, is a defined term. Maybe one paragraph says, the drawings and specifications with no capitals must do this. And another paragraph talks about the instruments of service, and when you go back to that definition of instruments of service, drawings and specifications within that are capitalized. So you have two different things. So they're not inconsistent. I was drafting a contract last night, and a lot of times, I represent a lot of owners, mostly owners, right? I mean, sometimes I have a lot of contractors and architects, but mostly owners. And what I recommend, at least to almost all my owners, is that they're a contract on a project of a significant size. If we get to $10 million or above, I say it's worth it for you to pay to get an owner's representative. There's someone that's not an architect, not a contractor, and they sit over here on your side, and they make sure the architect is doing their work and the contractor is doing the work, because they understand construction. You're really smart, my client, because you hired me, you got me smart. But you're really smart. But you don't know construction. So you shouldn't be the one. If you're going to spend $10 million or more, pay a little money to somebody who's special. When I went that contract, owner's representative, the OER capitalized, and we defined and we identified that person. However, in the AIA contract, they also talk about the owner of the building, owner of the project, capital O, and they have a representative, someone that works for the owner, that speaks to them, that can sign off on documents, that has agency, but agency later, but it's the person for the company that's in charge of the project. There's always going to be somebody that comes in charge of the project. That's with a small one. So as you read through my contract, there's sometimes in the provision will say the owner's representative does this. It's capital O, capital R. You know we're talking about the person that's identified. That's a judicial rule versus capital O, smaller. So that's just how we make sure. So there may be a paragraph that says owner's representative does X, and another paragraph that says owner's representative does Y. They don't seem consistent, but because there's a judicial rule on defined terms, we know when we read them and they're not necessarily inconsistent. Does that make sense? There's all different judicial rules. Questions?
So the judicial rule is the defined term. And the example of the contract rule would be like the lower case
term? No, that's a good question. Let me see if I can make it clear. There are judicial rules that apply to every contract. Capitalized terms. Specific over general. Those are judicial rules where there have been case law after cases after cases after cases. So we know that we're going to walk into court. There's a law, a rule that the trier of law will say, this is how you must read this term. So when we're looking at it, these two paragraphs, are they really inconsistent? The first thing the judge will tell you is you have to read them following these rules. So that applies to all contracts. A contractual rule may be that that'll apply to any construction contract. If any contract, from business, the doctor, the lawyer, the sales, whatever it is, that judicial rule covers contract as a huge umbrella. A contractual rule may be following the one to an applied term. So an applied term in a construction contract is you are going to be following industry standards. Industry standard actually has a definition that we can create, I sometimes put into my contract. But the concept of industry standard is that kind of like standard care. You're going to work like everybody else does in the industry. And so when you're reading that contract in construction and it says industry standard, you're going to pour in that understanding of what industry standard is. And it's not necessarily because it's a rule that covers it. The industry standard may be different in business than it is in construction. Does that make sense? Okay. Anything else in the part? Okay. Rule stated in the term of the contract resolves inconsistencies. So there's often a paragraph you'll see that'll say the contract needs to be read in, or that the contract documents, capital C, capital D, and I'll explain that in a second, need to be read in the following order. So when you have a construction project, you're going to have the owner contractor agreement and the owner architect agreement. So you have two agreements. You're going to have the drawing specifications, capital D, capital S. You're going to have what's called a change order. Anybody here know what a change order is? A couple people. Okay, explain what the change order is. During the course of a construction project, I may decide, you know what? I need a bigger porch. You guys designed the porch, but I need it bigger. You priced out the project with the porch that I had, but I want it bigger, so we are changing the design, and we are changing the construction. And so both the architect and the contractor will say, that cost you money because I have to do more work. If they change to the original agreement, so a change order is written up. We write it down, we say what's going to happen, the money and the time, and that becomes, so a change order is a change to the original agreement, and you put the money. There's all these other things that include, there's amendments, there's addendums, there's all these other things that make up what's called contract documents. Capital T, C, capital D, the contract documents. Have all these other things together. So a defined term with a bunch of other defined terms. Okay, now I have a contract that has two agreements, and change orders, and amendments, and exhibits, and all these other stuff. And I'm reading them, and I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Which is more important? What if I'm reading a drawing, and I look at the change order, and it's a difference in the drawing that was in the original documents? What's more important? What I put into my agreement is a paragraph that's called interpretation of contracts. And it says, you read in the following order, change order before agreement, agreement before drawing, drawing before, or specifications, specifications before drawing. You just list them out. So back in rules, so when you're reading, and that goes to your question also about principles, within the contract, it's going to tell you. So, one document may supersede another, such as specifications supersede drawing.
Question.
Is it not explicitly stated within the contract? Or is there a thing that would be a specific thing? Great question. So we'll change your question a little bit differently. If it's not an express term in the contract, from 2 slides ago, is it implied? Is it an implied term? And yes, there are industry standards. And that's when we go into more, do we look back to the judicial rule, we have a judicial rule that'll carry it and cover it, that's on top, or do we have an industry rule? And so when we look to the interpretation, the concept, especially in construction, specific over general, everybody knows that. So if you don't write that in your contract, industry standard says you read this contract as specific over general. A lot of times you're going to find that actually in the drawings themselves. I had a big case where it came down to there was the specifications that talked about how windows and lintels and what are called NDAMs need to be installed. An NDAM is when you have a window and there's a brick coursing because water can get behind brick. If the water comes, there needs to be some type of of material. Often it's a piece of metal that's turned up, and it creates literally a dam so the water doesn't get into the window area and cause rotting. So there was a general statement in the specifications that said this is how you install end dams. There were drawings for different windows, and they were not consistent. But the drawings were more specific. So for this area, you have to install it this way, and this you install it this way. Even though the general specifications matched one, it didn't match both, but that's where you would look at the specific ownership in the construction. Okay. Requiring lengthier terms or more extensive procedures. That's also something that everybody kind of understands. If we say, if you're going to install something, construction industry standard that if it's a more difficult, more lengthy, that's probably what they want over this general slap it up. How do you install this type of structure or whatever it might be? And then identifying who has the duty of inquiring about the inconsistency. If I'm a contractor, if I'm a good contractor, I know that the drawings I'm going to get are not 100%, because nobody can draw every single end dam on every single window in every single building. You just can't do that. And that goes for everything over and over and over and over and over. There's so many things that go through the construction of buildings. You can't put that all into the drawing. But the contractor should be able to understand that. They should be able to do it because they've done these buildings over and over. That's why we have somebody that just standard of care. So, what happens though if I'm a contractor and I'm looking at a drawing and I don't understand it? I still have to raise my hand as a contractor, and that is where we figure out who has the responsibility. And in fact, I put things in my contract that say, if a contractor knew or should have known that this was a mistake, and they do not raise this mistake, the contractor can't get a change order for it. They have to pay for it to be installed the right way. So you put a responsibility on the contractor to do their job. Again, the case that I was just talking about with the end dams and the windows and everything else, there was lots of times where the contractor was like, well, I didn't understand the drawings. That was in the testimony. But they never raised their hand. They never said anything. Unfortunately, I didn't write the contract. The contract was silent on these issues. And so there was a lot of times when the panel would come back and say, it seems like the architect just didn't do the job. So you need to make sure you put certain reasonable obligations on people in a contract. Contractors aren't designers, so they don't have to be an architect. But they see stuff all the time. So if they see it and they really should understand it, they should raise their hand. But if you put that language in your agreement, because it's stated in the contract of who's supposed to read what and who's supposed to raise their hand when, then we know when you're the jury and you're trying to interpret what the agreement was or what the breach was, what the terms were. You know that one person didn't do their job because they didn't raise their hand. That's the conclusion. Legally, the contract told you, raise your hand, you didn't, so therefore you couldn't breach. Does that make sense? Question like that? Yes, because it puts the obligation, it becomes a duty. One of the duties of the contract, where we talked about duty last week and everything else, the contract establishes what your obligations are. So if the contractor in the situation, building a 3-bedroom, 3-bath house, that's the basis. Yes, you can build a house. Another duty, and why I'm paying you so much money, is if you can't understand the architect's drawing, raise your hand. If you don't raise your hand and you build it wrong and the wall falls down, I'm going to see both you and the architect if the architect designed it incorrectly. You're going to be like, I built it exactly like the drawing. And you, and I say to you as the contractor, but you should have known this because it's really clear that whatever was missing. And there's lots of stuff in industry standards that the contractor should know. So it puts an obligation on both parties. Clearly the architect is screwed up for the drawing that could, but so are you. If you had asked your question and the architect gave you the answer, then the architect, or gave you the clear answer, or they just said build it the way it's drawn, then the architect carries the full percentage. And a lot of times in construction cases, that judge or jury has to try to set balances and says, who has more responsibility? You're going to have where the wall falls down and the jury's going to be like, that was 95% the architect's fault, only 5% the contractor. Or 50-50, or whatever they might feel and understand from what happened during the course of the project. Anything else on this question?
the way it's going to do it. What happens then if it just like becomes hearsay? Like if it's now written that the architect told me to be drawn to
the way. Oh, that's a great question. So the question being, hearsay, just so everybody understands. So hearsay is an out-of-court statement, so all of our statements that go on in any life are out-of-court. But that they use to try to prove something. So we get the trial, the wall has fallen down, the contractor raised their hand, put it in writing in what's called a RFI, request for information, and sent it to the architect and said, hey, these drawings are unclear, I'm worried about the one the wall is, or whatever they might say. Can you please clarify that? And the architect, while they're on the project site, says, just build it the way it's drawn, it's fine. As opposed to writing it down. And the wall falls over. You're right, it's a problem because how do we prove that? It becomes difficult. And if the contractor should try to defend themselves, says, well, he told me that the wall needs to be built that way, it is potentially a hearsay issue because you're trying to prove an out-of-court statement, and that may or may not come into evidence. There's lots of stuff that we don't have to worry about evidence or the rules of procedure and things like that, but that's a problem. So what do you do as a contractor? After the architect tells you on the project site, you go back to your trailer or wherever you're going to be doing it, and you send an email. You say, following our conversation, you told me to do this, and you send it off. If they don't respond, one of the rules of interpretation of contract, silence when you send something, means accept. So, for that type of thing. If they write back and say, I didn't say that, well, now we have a paper trail. So, part of it is I'm giving you a advice as your lawyer, papers, if you only get it a word. But part of it is, once you do that, then we have rules, based on this, of how to interpret. Okay? Here are the rules for contractual construction. Follow the specific, these that I've talked about before, follow the specific rather than over the general. Construe the contract language against the party who drafted that contract, and then construe the contract as a whole, title, stating the provision more consistent with the overall contractual intent. So let's talk about these in reverse order. So, we construe the contract as a whole, that's what I was talking about before. The four corners of the document, everything in there. So you may have two provisions that appear to be inconsistent, but when you read the contract as a whole, you'll understand. Let me give you an example. On a construction project, with a project that you build, the general contractor is going to have all the subcontractors under him. And the general contractor is going to give you a project schedule. We're going to start on January 1st, and by February 15th, the hole will be dug in the ground, and by the February 22nd, we'll pour the concrete, and there's this Gantt chart. You guys know what a Gantt chart is? So it's a bar chart, basically a bar chart. So there's a bar chart that they use to create a schedule, okay? So you're going to have the schedule that the contractor should follow. And there are different trades. You're going to have the concrete people, you're going to have the people that dig the hole, you're going to have the rough carpentry, finished carpentry. All these different trades are going to be coming on to build the house, okay? The contractor, in the agreement, is responsible for the coordination of their trades. All these people that are on the project site, making sure that that ants aren't crawling all over the ship. That they, you know, this area is available for the plumber to work on this day, while the electrician is working on this area. So you have to make sure, both logistically, where they are in the building, and sequentially, who's going to be doing what when. That's the general contractor's job. The owner may have their own specialty contractor coming. Let's say I'm building a hotel, and I want to have a really cool restaurant on the main floor. So I'm going to bring in this, like, architect guy, somebody, woman, whoever it is, known for designing really cool restaurants. And so you're not going to leave it to your normal architect, and you're not going to leave it to the contractor, and you're going to have the drawing, this box, this area on the drawing, that's blank, says not in contract. So the contractor's not responsible for it, neither the architect, because I, as the owner, hire two other people to handle it. Who coordinates that? Who's responsible for when my people come in? Is it me? And when my person comes, because I'm the one hiring them, I must have overseen two other people. Is it me as the owner? Well, sometimes I get right into the contract. Construe the contract as a whole, favoring the provision more consistent with the overall contract intent. If the contract is silent, the contract intent is that the contractor will take care of their people, and I'll take care of my people. And that's the intent of the agreement. If there's some language that says the contractor is responsible for coordination over the entire project, capital T, versus work, capital W, work is what the contractor is supposed to do, project is everything. So if it says the contractor is responsible for coordination of the entire project, the contractor is responsible for coordinating my people. So what's the intent? Even though it doesn't say specifically, because it says contractors must coordinate the project, it doesn't say specifically, it's not in express terms, it says contractors must coordinate owners' separate contractors. It just says contractor must coordinate the project. Well, you know, P is everything for project, capital P. W, capital W, is just the word for the contractor by two different terms. So we can take the intent of the whole contract and say, from that, I can imply and state legally, you are responsible to handle and carry them separate contractors. So that's just that last one. Question on this part? Right, this middle one here. Construe the contractual language against the party who drafted the contract. I wanted to leave that one last because while it is a rule and a judicial rule of how you're supposed to read contracts, the courts are generally going to say if you are two parties, even if it's David and Goliath, if you are two parties that negotiated fairly and you came to a written agreement, the court's going to look at you both as equals. And they're not going to say we're going to hold one provision against another. Now, if you can show that there was a bias, if you can show that there was unequal weight and balancing, you may be able to get the court to say, I'm going to construe the provision against you, meaning you, the contractor, even though you think it says this, I'm going to say no because I'm going to take the other side's position because I'm going to construe it against you. That sometimes happens, but rarely. But it is a contractual rule, and you're going to find, if you're ever out there, you're going to say, well, I wanted to do this, but they wouldn't let me, or whatever it might be. There's times when it could come up, but by and large, this judicial rule, the judge or the court is going to say, we think you're even, we think you're balanced. We will talk about, as we get later on, and discuss some examples of where there is an equal bargaining power and what the courts will do with that, but for general purposes, even though that middle one seems like it could go one or the other, the courts like to look at everybody on the same page. Questions? Yes, over there. True means exactly what you said, that's true language. So I'm going to read it, I'm going to think about what it means, whether it's expressly written or the exact, and I'm going to construe, I'm going to state that this is what it means. I'm going to come to a conclusion that this is what this term means, per the reason, per the bargain that this is part of the intention. Modification of contract after the execution agreement. That's a chamber of thing I was going to talk about. Every contract, well not every contract, but I'd say 99.whatever% of your construction projects are going to have a change order. Something just like a little bit of different, a little bit here, a little bit there. There's going to be some kind of change. So you have to, when we sign the contract, we are within the four corners, we have drawings that are set in stone, we have specifications that are set in stone, we have all these rules that are set in stone, but something happened. I was digging in the ground and I thought we were going to have solid soil weekend, but it was filthy and sandy. So I need to get different footing. So whatever might happen, because we don't know everything. So what do? We have to modify or change the contract. So, modification by agreement of the parties. That's one way we can do it. The parties who sign a contract may always, always agree to modify the contract. Now, there's going to be a provision you're going to see from time to time in the contract, and we'll talk about this, and there will be a question on the test, but I'm not going to tell you how that one goes. One question, I never change my thing up. But it talks about that you cannot modify this contract unless it's in writing. It's not true. Even though it's in writing, but you can't modify this contract in writing, and both parties read it and wrote it and agreed to it. You can always agree to modify the contract. And so two parties later on say, hey, let's change this, and we're in agreement with it, even though it says it has to be in writing, you both agree to change the contract. And you both agree to ignore the rule that it has to be in writing, and so the contract changed. So, question. Well, it depends on what the agreement was. If they agree orally and they start building what you wanted to do, like you add a porch, and they start building the porch, have they modified the contract even though it's not in writing? Because they agreed to build it. You asked them to build your porch. And that's where the question becomes in, and that's where the fight comes in. That's why I'm not going to go and tell you what the question is specifically. So there's going to be a question on that. Then, trust me, don't worry about it. Once I have to come, I put the question and answer out of course, I don't want to have a discussion. Oh, I forgot to tell you, did I talk to you guys about the pizza party? I did? Yeah, it's a midterm. Okay, yeah, so we'll talk about it. It always comes up, because it's going to be on the first exam. And it always comes up, and it's always a fun debate, and I always share the video. And then sometimes I throw the question out, sometimes I leave it in. So sometimes, if like everybody gets the question wrong, or if like 3/4 of the class gets the question wrong, just throw it out. You know, we can get it. If you got it right, you get the point, and you can get it right, it doesn't matter. In any event, you become in this question, back to your question is, did they agree or did they not agree? And that becomes like my two favorite words, did they say? What did they agree to or not? And what was the agreement? Was the agreement to be paid? Was it a modification? But the parties can always agree to modify the contract. Always. And remember, to agree, you have to have offer, acceptance, the acceptance has to mirror, consideration. Remember those rules back when? So when you modify a contract, you still have to have those same rules in the beginning that we had of what makes a contract. Because you have to have an agreement. It's just an agreement. It's a continued agreement of the other party. But you have to have those, all those components that we talked about last week. Okay. Even a contract that forbids modification can be modified. That's the same thing. You can't modify the contract without writing. Don't ever do it. So, there can even be a little modification within the contract. And the timing of the modification. When did they modify what's modified? We go back to those rules we were talking about last week. Offer acceptance. When was they offer? When was they acceptance? What was determined? When we're talking about adding this porch and how much it costs. When was that done? And what was the agreement? Had they already started building it before you guys entered the agreement on the price? Was there ever a discussion on the price? When did those things come down? And it seems like it's really simple, but a lot of times you're going to find on this kind of the modification that people will just start going ahead. Architects will start drawing right away without getting approval. And then you're like, okay, do I have to pay for this or not? As the owner, maybe I haven't made my decision. You know, what do you do on a project where the contractor sees the problem with the soil, knows that it has to be fixed, knows that they're going to be putting in a change order request for it, and they start digging and changing it already. And then a week or two later, they send a letter that says we had to fix this, and here's the bill. Does the owner have to pay for that? The work's done. Contractor was being reasonable, following the industry standards of how to install that footing. When you have this type of soil condition, does the owner have to pay for it? The work was finished. Does the contract say you cannot work unless you've had a writing and a change order? Then the owner could say, thank you for doing that, but I'm not going to pay you for that because you never asked for a change order. Because maybe the footing that the contractor put in was more expensive than what the architect could have designed. Maybe the architect said we could have done it differently and it would have been half the price of what we did. Why should the owner have to pay for that? Maybe the owner paid for that. There's lots of things. So timing of when that agreement occurred is important. Question? That's a great question. And the answer is, if there's no written agreement that doesn't tell what the rules are, yes, you could say, I'm doing what's industry standard. I saw this. I didn't think it was complex. I've done this all the time. I was putting this in the foundation for a living. This is what should have happened. And you could make the argument that it was within the boundaries of the industry standard and the expectation of what that contractor should have done, that subcontractor doing that footing. If the contract, which that's why you have it in writing, and every contract, every type of contract, because you know, everyone uses exact twos, but the majority of the construction contracts are going to have a provision, a section, a change order. And it's going to say, you can't do a change order unless it's in writing signed by the parties. And if that's in there, there is no clause in the contract because the written express contract says, you can't do that. So, that's the issue. But yeah, it's a great question. Anything else? Action for reformation of contracts. We talked a little bit about this last week, and it's going to be on the stage. I think it's on the so sometimes, yeah. Remember I told you a couple of days, it was like 10 minutes ago, that you're never supposed to rewrite a contract? Well, there's this thing called reformation when you can rewrite a contract. So, reformation is when the written terms of the contract do not actually reflect to the actual agreement between the parties. You're like, wait a minute, wait a second. You just said we have to look at the clear and unambiguous terms. And the clear and ambiguous term says X. And they signed it and it said X. And then you also told me I can't change that. So I'm going to tell the jury, I'm a judge, I'm tell the jury, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, if you see clear and ambiguous terms, you must objectively follow those clear and ambiguous terms. Well, sometimes during that course of the testimony, party A says, well, I know it says X, but I thought it meant Y. And party B says, I thought it meant Y too, as well. When you have two people that say, we agree to what it is, which is different, the court then can reform the reformation. When the two parties, we have to make sure it actually reflects the agreement between the two parties. Let me think of an example that would come up. Let's say that I'm a developer and I bought, I think I talked a little bit about this last week, I bought a warehouse and it's zoned industrial. And my job or my goal is I wanted to convert that warehouse into an office apartment. It'd be cool, you know, stuff like that. And so I want to redevelop that. I want to gut it and I want to get it converted. And so I sign up a contract, I sign an architect to start doing the design for it. And we both know that they are designing for this residential space. We both expect that there's going to be a change in the zoning from residential to, I'm sorry, from industrial to residential, so we can actually build in this area. And maybe I bring in a contractor to do some work or whatever, and the contractor thinks that they're going to get this job, and so they put a team aside and they say, we're going to have these people ready to go and all sort of stuff. And we don't want the zoning changed. Or maybe neither of us knew that the zoning was wrong. But we both expected to be either designing or building a residential space. That was the intent. But the contract doesn't have that in there because the contract issues effectively, part of this, you have to follow the specifications and laws. The contract effectively says you have to follow laws before it says you can't build this. And you can't, nothing can happen here because it's zoned, it's industrial. So the court may reform the contract and say that the contractor may say, I should be getting money because I'm keeping my team here aside waiting. I'm waiting because I want to do this project and I want to, the owner really wants this team A. And I'm going to charge the owner to keep this team A kind of warm, hot in the cold, ready to go. The owner could say, I don't have to pay that because it's industrial. Both parties are going to say, but we both thought we were going to be doing a residential project. The court may reform and say to the owner, you asked him to keep that team on hold. I know that the contract should follow the law, and the law says it's industrial, but you both thought it was residential, and you asked him to keep it on hold. They may have to pay for that. They may reform the contract so the owner has to pay for the contractor to keep his team on hold. That will be a place where the contractor could potentially prevail, even though the agreement is talking about, even though it's, and it's implied in the agreement, that this would be, have to be designed for an industrial area. Does that make sense on that kind of concept? To reform a contract, you need to have a lawsuit. You need to go to court. Some judge has to say that it can't be arbitration. Some judge has to say this is what the contract meant. It's the only time when you specifically seek reformation, there's a count in there that says, I am asking for this provision to be written to say this, or the contract is about that. In this example that I gave, contractors has like a, you know, a $50,000 bill keeping all these people waiting. The contractor would sue and say, even though nowhere in there does it say I should get the $50,000 specifically because it's the residential versus industrial, I'm going to sue and ask the court to add that in. We both thought we were designing the building and going to be in a residential area. We both had that agreement. We knew exactly what it was, except it wasn't. So I then want to have the provision interpreted to do that, to give a question there.
I think measures where, let's say you're the owner and it's in the contract, but then two people agree, so then they seek a reformation, but they kind of, I mean, to your non-knowledge, they kind of behind the scenes agree, and they kind of went against you, how do you defend them?
When you say there are two parties, are you saying other than the owner?
Yeah.
Okay. So in that instance, then there is no reformation agreement because the only people that are relevant to the contract are the parties to the contract. So your contractor and owner, and I actually had a case like this, it's a great question, years ago, my first federal court, federal trial, it was a 3.5, that's what I was talking about last week when I said when I was down at 1 foot of digital, would be one. I think I said that last week, did I? Yeah, okay. I sometimes tell a lot of stories over and over and over, the good ones, at least I think, the funny ones. So sometimes I made reference to the story to go, what are you talking about? It's either because I saw it last year, I told somebody on a blog, or you know, one of my guys now, I just remember. Anyway, back to your point. The parties to the agreement have to agree of what it is. They have to have this mutual agreement that may be inconsistent with the terms of the contract. And so, then when one party wants to impose or require one of those previously agreed on terms that's not in the agreement, the other side can say, I don't have to do that, it's not in the agreement. That's when you sue for reformation. We agreed originally, the two of us. So the court comes in, and you have to just point out here, the party seeking reformation has said, well, so why would I just go with that? You can mistake that, and those things will go to the center. But in this instance, what you're talking about here is a third party entering the agreement. So I'll give you the example of what happened on a project that I had. So I represented a company that made what's called rack-supported structures. So like your normal, this is a giant storage facility for food products. So there was a freezer section, a refrigerator section, and a dryer section. It was huge. It was giant. It distributed food for like four states. So it was this massive project. And when you normally build a building, a lot of times you use the red iron steel. That's all like the items that are, you know, put the structure up. In a rack-supported structure, there's that tiny, but there's this called roll-form steel. And it's like a Lincoln Log, or not Lincoln Log, like a Tinker Toy or Electroset. Maybe you guys don't even know what that is, but you put the structure up, more like Lego Technic, if anybody does Lego. You put the structure up, and the structure itself is a bunch of grids, and it supports it. There's no this large steel. The regular red iron steel. So that's how the building was put together. Very specialized. So my client, was the company that designed the building and manufactured the steel of how it all went together, how the giant represent went together. There are specialty contractors, because it's specialty work, of how they're supposed to put it together. So we hired the specialty contractor underneath us. The owner hired us to build the whole thing, lock, stock, and barrel, design, build. So there's an owner, there's my company, design, build, but my company designs it and manufactures the steel, doesn't erect it, we hired the erector. Problems happen in the course of the project. Snow, ice, rain, miscommunication, blah, 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 and the project was really done. And as one of my consultants said, the owner hated us from the last meeting. They didn't like us from the very beginning. They just hated us. It's just never going to work. So the owner went around behind her back and started talking to our director and said, hey, if we get them out of the picture, will you sign a contract and finish this project? We really like you. And they did. And we sued them for what's called purchase interference with contractual relations. But that agreement behind us didn't change the terms of provision that we have with the owner. So we sued them on our contract. They were like, well, this and this and this and this. We're like, I don't care what you guys did back here. It has nothing to do with us. So there's no reformation or anything like that. Alright, so they have to have a good reason. Usual mistake of fact. We both factually thought that this area was zoned residential. It's zoned as industrial, so we're going to reform the contract, other provisions of the contract, because you both had this mistake of fact, so we're allowed to make you pay for pay the contractor to keep their trade wing. Fraud. Well, I thought that the contract said this, and it does, and I agree with exactly the express words in there. The other guy told me that they were going to do the exact words in there, but they were lying. So we want to reform the contract to say this is not what it was. And maybe the reformation of the contract ultimately ends up with precision, which we'll talk about in the next slide. But fraud is the reason why you can get reformation. The maybe just for a couple of provisions as opposed to the whole agreement. And then a unilateral mistake, but you need the other party's knowledge of the mistake. I knew that the contract that this is zoned industrial. But I knew when the owner was doing it, they thought it was residential. I never told them it was residential. So now I want to sue for reformation because the contractor's got to follow laws and it's industrial. And I, as a contractor, want my money for keeping my team in wages. I want my $50,000. Well, if we can prove, if the owner can prove that I knew that the owner had their own mistake, and it's hard, really, really hard, then there's no reformation. There's a good reason maybe the owner says, I want to reform it so that this contract doesn't happen at all. So we can change if there's one side knows that the other side was wrong, that they had a mistake in that. Okay? Yeah. Excuse me? The party that wants to remove, so the party that feels that they are owed something, we're going to be the ones that are going to file the lawsuit. Because if you think about it, let's say both the contractor and the owner agree that it should have been residential, and the contractor says, you know, you told me to keep these people kind of waiting. I know you thought that it would only be like a month because you were getting your money from your bank and you're dealing with a loan. But now it's going to be 4 months because it's got to go through the city and the zoning and blah, blah, blah. The owner and the contractor agree to some deal, but then both sides are going to have their own agreement and they ought to have already modified the contract. Because remember, you could always modify your own contract if you guys agree, which in and of itself is a reformation. Reformation in this context that we're talking about here is a legal term of art. So the party that's going to be seeking reformation as a legal and judicial remedy is the party that feels that they were injured. Contractor says, I'm owed this money, whatever the situation is. And that's in almost every lawsuit. The party that files the lawsuit is the party that wants relief, and the relief can be, we'll talk about it in a couple slides, because we're going to go to standard. But the relief can be monetary, it can be judgment relief, it can be things that the court can do. But that's who files it. You can file a counterclaim, like this case that I was talking about where we had the rat supported structure. They sued us first for $8 million because that's how much more it cost them to build the building. We countersued them for $2 million because they owed us a lot of money. So it was a $10 million loss. We both had claims against each other. We won, which was fine. A few of us, but we won. So they didn't get any of the $8 million, and they had to pay us. They didn't pay us the full amount, but not allowed to tell you how much they had to pay, because I'm going to do it like this as part of the agreement. We can't talk about that. But that happened. Both parties had a claim, so both parties filed an action. Counterclaim, there'd be no question.
Is this a claim for a monetary value? In their contract, also in place that pictures on an equal dispersion, or how did that money get dispersed?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
I guess it would involve the party, like who's involved. So like, okay, let's say you made the claim for $2 million on that structure.
Yes.
Is there a contract in place that determines how that money gets dispersed? Like, who does it go to?
Well, the money, if there's a judgment of, let's say there's a judgment of the full $2 million, the party who is sued, in this case is the owner, has to write a check to my client. It's simple as that. Now, our claim, which is true, was you owe us this $2 million because we had to pay party A, party B, party C, party D, the subcontractors that we had given hired. You owe us that money. Once we get the $2 million check, it is our job to distribute it to the people downstream. And if we don't do that, they could sue us. because they're owed this money. And they may or may not have joined the lawsuit. They may just be sitting as interested parties. There's all sorts of ways that's handled, but that's what the basis is. Okay, now there's a breach. Now somebody did something wrong. Did you have a question? Okay, there's something wrong. So what are your remedies? How do we have remedies here? Okay, what is a breach of contract? The basic rule is simple. Breach of contract means the failure of a party to perform or fulfill its promise and or its obligations under contract. Really basic. I promised to do this, I didn't do it. But what, you know, I'm talking about, like the AIA, A201, is 47 pages, 10.5. There are a lot of promises in there. It's not just simply, I'm going to build this to do a good job. So there's a lot of things that could be breached, and some are called material breaches, and some are minor breaches. You have minor breaches all the time. Oh, I'm supposed to get this finished by Tuesday, it's Thursday. That's a breach. Is it material enough that you can sue them for breach of contract? Do you have damages? Are you injured if it's 2 days late? You may. One of my earliest cases that I ever worked on, way back when I was a little baby, so I didn't really have much to do with it, but it was a casino down in New Orleans. And in the casino, the amount of money that they lost per day on the slot machines alone was astronomical. So we have this provision in the contract that says you must have the doors open by September 1st, whatever it is. And so every day you don't get us to open the door, so you can't start getting the line bandit going, it's $1 million a day the contract had to pay. This was like 30 years ago, so it could have been 5 or 10 million now. It was huge. So that 2 days that I just said was like a material breach, that's $2 million. Back then, so you can have these things, it's called a liquidated damage clause, and we're going to get to it in a second, but there are things, so it depends on what contract it is, what material is, but there's lots of obligations in the agreement, and a breach is the failure to perform one of those obligations. So breach can be significant enough to terminate or sue, or not, if you have big breaches and little breaches. Okay. Breach of contract monetary. Come to the contractual evidence that put the innocent party, the party says, oh, I'm owed this money, or oh, I was the one that was wrong, in the position he would have been in had the contract been fully performed. We want to make sure that the parties get to where they thought they should have been. What the party was fully performed. The purpose is not about punishment for the party who breached. In fact, you are not allowed to have penal clauses, penalty clauses in a contract. The only time you can get a punishment when you get extra money that they want to have a punishment is something like fraud. Now you may hear like there's cases like I'm going to get the numbers wrong. And, you know, there was a case against Apple. It had to do with intellectual property rights, and I think the jury came down with a couple hundred million dollar verdict, but then there was punitive damages for like $1 billion. It was like, and this happened, you'll still read about this in the news, and then they litigated and they tried to negotiate it down and everything else. There were certain reasons, maybe a statute that was violated or other things that happened, that can allow a jury or judge to award what's called punitive damages. But the contract itself, you cannot have a provision in the contract that creates, a penalty. It is all about making sure to get the parties back where they need. So if we have two types of remedies, we have legal, more normally a legal remedy is going to be monetary damages. We have equitable, an action and not monetary, like an injunction. You must stop doing this, or you must do that. That's an injunction, so the court is telling the parties they must do something, do an action, but it may not have monetary results. Or consequential liquidated damages and punitive damages. So as you said, you don't get a penalty, but there are some laws and uses where you can sometimes have them that are outside of the normal terms of contract. Liquidated, we'll talk about consequential. These are three types of remedies and damages. Monetary damages for breach of contract. First one you're going to think about is what's called expectation. making an innocent party whole as if the contract is performed. Expectation damage is the most common resolution in restructuring, or in any breach of contract, not just restructuring. It's what I expected should happen. If you were designing for me a 3-bedroom, 3-bath house, and I said I can use $50,000, and then during the course of the project, you're like, I'm retiring, not going to do this anymore, and you charge me some money, I got to go out and hire another architect to do the job. You had a contract. You are now, even though you're retiring, happy for you and everything else, you had a contract, you were going to design my house. That's your promise. You have not reached that promise. I got to go out and take someone now to finish your drawing. I thought I was going to have to only pay $50,000 for this work. That's your promise to me. But because I got this other person to do it, I got to pay like 70 or 80. The difference between what I had to pay, what I had to pay to get the same project done, to what I thought I was going to pay, makes me whole. I should only have to pay $50,000 for it. If I had to pay $70,000, you owe me $20,000. You breached it. I expected to have this delivery for $50,000, cost me $70,000. Simple math.
Questions?
Excellent question. Yes, the concept is that I believe you're asking is, I wanted you to design me a house, let's call it a Chevy, and I built a Mercedes. Do I have the obligation? It cost me $50,000 for the Chevy. That I went out and found this really cool architect and I had to pay $150,000 for the Mercedes drawings. Am I entitled to $100,000? And the answer is no, I am not. There's a term of law called betterment. You're not entitled to get something better than what the deal was. So it's not a standard of care question in the sense of you're, because you probably could design the Mercedes, but I didn't hire you to design the Mercedes. I hired you to design me a Chevy house. That normal, average 3-bedroom, 3-bath house. So yes, if I go out and take advantage of that, or do more, that's called betterment. It happens all the time. I had a case where, I can't remember the name of the university, of the city. Anyway, the city out in Southwest, or like the western side of the state, middle of Illinois, there's a famous college there too. Anyway, tweeted that my client did the wastewater treatment system for it. They actually installed the pumps for their wastewater treatment system. The pumps failed. We gave them a new one. That one failed. We gave them a new one. So we gave two new ones, and we sent the third one, and they didn't install it. They were like, we're tired of this, blah, blah, blah. Turns out there was a whole bunch of other issues that had nothing to do with our pump, both the design, the designer that they hired and everything else. But they went and hired a brand new architect, engineer. And the engineer installed, like ours was the Chevy, the engineer installed a cabin. Didn't go to the Mercedes, didn't install a cabin. And our defense against them was that. He said, you guys put in much more sophisticated, more expensive systems than you asked for us. So you can't get all the money. We gave him some money because we wanted to settle the case, but that was the big defense in that. It's the most common theory. The injured party recovers the difference between the cost to complete the contract by another and the agreed on cost in the original party form. That's that. I thought I was going to pay 50, I had to pay 70, you owe me 20. The result, you get what you expected for the value which you agreed. I got what I expected, I only should have to pay 50, you have to make up the difference. That's all I'm asking for. Not asking for something more, I'm asking for what our agreement was. We all agreed, we're going to put us in the position where we thought we were at the contract difference. I hope you have a wonderful retirement. I'm sorry for $20,000 on a retirement fund, but you could have come down in a couple more months. Whatever you might want to say. But that's what his expectation is. Exactly what it sounds like. I expected to get this. Okay. Reliance damage. It's awarded to the injured party who foreseeably relied on a promise. It could be even an unenforceable promise. So you acted because you relied on a promise by the other party. You get what you deserve based on the promise. All paid with a car and buy. So what the concept here is, I think of the same with awards and construction. So I hire you as an architect to design what people over there are talking about, especially wastewater systems. We enter into an agreement. You're going to design it. We give the specifications of what the volume of water is, the volume of waste, and all the other information, blah, 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 that you need to design it. And you tell me you have the team. I rely on you. I want to make sure that it's done properly. And then it turns out we don't have a team. Well, I relied on you, and maybe what ends up happening, actually I can even bring this back to Haribo in a second, but what ends up happening is I have to pay more money because I relied on you. And okay, I'll give you the exact example because it's a Haribo issue that I can talk about. When you make candy, when you make Haribo gummy bears, they put them on these trays that are like little indentations, little bears, the gummy part, the goo, is put into this giant tray about this big, and there's a whole bunch of little bears, and it's the imprint. That tray, so when they turn it over, if the gummy's dry, when you turn it over so they fall off, they don't stick, has starch on it. It's all this starch. So there's all this powder, really, really fine powder all around. Okay? That gets all on the floors of the facility, because every single tray, when they're making millions of gummy bears, there's millions of trays and everything else. That starch has to be washed down, because it's a clean facility, so you wash the floors down, it goes down the drain, it goes to the wastewater treatment facility. Because you can't just take that starch and put it back into Lake Michigan, because we all have the factories up on, right near Kenosha. So, it's going to go into the pipe system, it's going to go through the county of Kenosha, but it's about Lake Michigan. Can't have all this particulate extra stuff. Even though it's made in that sample, there are rules about what you can dump into the water. So, my client expected that this wastewater treatment facility would hold the residuals out so that the water they were putting into the city of Kenosha's pipes in the village of Pleasant Prairie would be clean. It wasn't. Wastewater treatment facilities are not working properly. So what does my client have to do? Every month they have to, all the water goes to a different place. They can't use the facility. And they have to pay fines and they have to pay extra money to the village of Kenosha to clean the water. So it's possible. So I relied on you to design me a wastewater treatment facility that will operate properly. That was your promise. It's now costing me money because you failed in your promise. I relied on you. So my damage is I either want my money back or I get the value of the money that I have to pay as my damages because I relied on you. That's a reliance damage coverage. The wastewater treatment facility is there. It's not working properly, so we're going to have both of the things we're talking about. It's going to be expectation value part of it. How much does it cost to fix it? But because I rely on you that it should be working from day one, and I have these other damages, we're going to have a reliance here too. So we'll have two things. Does that make sense? Restitution damages. Where one party has provided benefit to the other, and the first party is compensated for providing that benefit. That's kind of like that quasi contract. You're going to say, hey, I did something for you. You were unjustly enriched. Going back to my house where I talked about that the roofer was up there and then saw while he was up there, there was another party next to him. I was unjustly enriched by getting paid for that. So he's seeking that he had sued me, but they're not going to pay you like a couple grand or much. But I said, they're not paying you for that, so they're entitled to that. There's going to be this quasi contract that came up because there wasn't any specific, which is an oral agreement to fix my roof. And he's going to say, I want restitution. I want to be made whole because you have been unjustly enriched. So that's restitution. Recovery providing the benefit of the contract that was actually performed. House first, down, bring it in project. Well, this one here is only 2 months. Here's an example there. Oh, okay. So if this house burned down, So imagine that a contractor is building your my house, and it's 3/4 of the way in. I've been paying along, and then after God happens, the house gets struck by lightning and burns down. Maybe there's 2 months that I still owe them. I'm like, I'm not paying you for that work. It's gone. I don't have any benefit. The whole house is gone. I've already paid you. Let's say the house is $500,000. I've already paid you $200,000, and you just sent me 2 invoices and another $100,000, and I got something burned to the ground. Now, it's not the contractor's fault, because lightning hit the project and started on fire. So the contractor can sue for restitution. He says, you still, even though the house is burned down, I put something into it. And while it was still there, had it not been for God, or whatever you want to say, the lightning was caused by it, you are in the damage. And so the court will order you to pay that $100,000. Question?
So the insurance company, so the owner paid for it to get fixed so it would open, and then they would go after the driver of the car.
So that, yeah, okay, so the situation, and I'll do this from time to time during class when you ask the question, because your question may not pick up on my phone, sometimes I repeat it. So a car comes in, hits the library, portico falls down, there's a cost to that. The library goes to their insurance company, their property insurance, they rebuild it. Somebody's out. And if the car driver was negligent or something, unless they're striking again, they had a stroke or whatever, the car driver is responsible for those damages. So the library could sue the car driver, because that would be, it's a different type of tort, not because there's no contract, but it's a tort, it's damage to property. So the library could sue the driver for negligence and where they drive. Or, in this instance, the library didn't want to get the lawsuit, so they did what's called subrogation. They subrogated their right and said, if you fix this, and that's what happens almost in all insurance companies, if you fix it, you stand in my shoes and you can go after the driver. I don't want to spend the money and hire a lawyer. That's why I pay you the insurance company. Just pay for it and you fix it. So that's what I'll do. Yes, the driver would be the one that's responsible for that. That doesn't fall into necessarily restitution because it's not a contractual claim because you don't have a contract. That's a tort claim, which we'll get into tort in another lecture, but that's what would happen. Okay, so those were your monetary damages. Breach of contract, equitable remedy. An injunction. The court order requires or forbids an action. You hear about injunctions all the time, you know, like in the news all the time. Okay, we're going to stop doing that. In fact, I will just say this easily, and my law firm is Perkins Coie had an executive order against us that wouldn't allow me, but to read the letter, the exact written, the rule of law. I could not even go to a post office. It restricted any employee, not the lawyers, any employee of Perkins Coie from going into any government facility, unless we did all the other things. We filed an action against that executive order, my law firm, saying that it was a violation of a number of laws, First Amendment, Sixth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, some other stuff. And we got an injunction, and the court said, this executive order cannot be enforced. It's now the appellate court. So that's an injunction where they said, even though there's a presidential executive order, that executive order has been enjoined from being enforced. So I can still go to the post office, among those things. In construction, an injunction would be, I had a client years ago, and I may have already said this, they were a lighting designer. And they did the ceiling plan of the facility. And there was problems with payments, and the owner didn't like the designer, what they were doing, and blah, blah, blah. And they fired our client, which they were entitled to do under the contract, except they owed my client $450,000. The client, the owner, then took our drawings and gave it to another lighting designer, and they erased our name from my client's name from the title block of the drawing, and started happily building the project, but they literally had our exact drawings. So not only was, so there was a copyright infringement, we had a breach of contract claim against the owner, we felt we were owed our money, so we wanted to have our damages for what we had performed, and I said, we can go to regular court, we can file a breach of contract claim, which we did, but it's going to take longer. Your, as I said earlier in class, copyright is like your lifeblood. I said, your copyright infringement, they are using your drawings. We can get an injunction to stop them from using your drawing, which stopped the whole project. So we got that injunction. The court said you were not allowed to use these drawings. We got to make payments. So an injunction ultimately resulted in us getting monetary damages. So we didn't have to go and prove up your contract claim in court. We got an injunction to stop the project. So that's an injunction. Forbid somebody from doing or require somebody from doing. So they require you. Less, not less common, but you more frequently need injunctions to stop. Rescission. Rescission is undoing the contract and returning the party to the pre-contractual status quo. I gave that example last week, a few weeks ago, I'm not sure which, where there was the subdivision, people own a house in the subdivision. Did I talk about this? Okay. So there was water that went into the basement of the subdivision. My client didn't know it was going to flood. And so when the court came in and said, I'm going to rescind this contract like it never happened. You can move out of the house. They give you your $560,000 or whatever they paid for the house back. And we're like, it never happened. They're going to rescind the contract. Results in the resolution is if the contract has never existed, that's rescission. And again, it's rarely, the rescission and reformation, we talked about in the last slide, or a couple slides before, they are rarely used. It's more difficult to get rescission. You have to have really egregious situations here. It has to be long before the parties kind of were entrenched with what's going on. That's why we were able to get it with this homeowner. But it is a, one of the remedies you can get as a as an injured party in the country. The other one here is specific performance. The court requiring the performance of the contract. So it's kind of like an injunction. An injunction is only a temporary. You have a temporary restraining order, and then you get an injunction, and once it becomes a permanent injunction, then it could be something that is like specific performance. But maybe in specific performance, you can skip the injunction part, you go and you ask them to do get the specifically due process. It's for something unique. Land is considered unique. So here's an example. I go in and I put a bid on a house. In Illinois, and in most states, you're not supposed to have competing bids at the same time. So there's a really nice house in the market, and like the real estate market's been crazy for, you know, 5-8 years now. And houses are being bought before they're even put on the market. And houses are being listed for, you know, price at $500,000 and they're going for $750,000. People bid above price like right away. So the market's crazy. And the rule is that if there is an offer pending, so a party comes and sees the house, they tell the realtor we want it, and we're going to offer the $500,000 that they're asking for that, the full offer asking price. And that realtor related to the other realtor. Timing, we come to an agreement, we're supposed to have an agreement, everything else. And then before the paperwork is signed, all of a sudden someone calls up the homeowner's realtor, the seller's realtor, and says, up to $700,000, and that was a $200,000 upkeep. They're not supposed to do that in Illinois. It happens all the time, and it, in most cases, people don't bring lawsuits against because it's so much money to bring a case in court. But if you did bring a case in that situation, the court could say to the homeowner, you must sell the house for $500,000. They're like, but there's a house across the street looks just like us. No, your house is unique. You accepted that term. That new provision, that new offer that came in, not only does the lawsuit can't do that, but you must sell it. Well, maybe we're not going to move now. We decided we're not going to move. No, you said you were going to move. You had another realtor, the two realtors exchanged agreements, specific performance. I'm going to require you to honor your duty, honor your obligation to the contract. So that is a remedy that's not monetary, but it's requiring them to do something. That specific performance, that specifically requires them. Now, the thing down here that says, can't have specific performance for services. That goes into the whole concept of executive services. You can't force someone to physically do something. If the court says you must, I use an example. Let's say that there was a contract with someone like, I don't know, let's say Ben Affleck was going to be a director in a movie, and they have a contract for that. And it says Ben Affleck's going to get paid $1 million to direct this movie. That's probably well under his pay grade. say he's going to get paid $1 million. And then Ben Affleck decides, you know what, I can't do this because of heavy family issues or whatever is going on, I don't know. But doesn't want to do the contract. The court cannot, and the studio says, but he signed the contract, we want specific performance, we must have Ben Affleck. We promised our backers we have Ben Affleck. All this other stuff. The court can't force Ben Affleck to direct the movie. There could be monetary damages. I have to go out and get another director that's going to be more expensive. Or my backers have dropped me because I don't have Ben Affleck. There are all these other types of damages that you get, but the court, because it's individual services, will not force Ben Affleck to direct that movie. So there are limits to this. Other remedies, breach of contract. Consequential damages is a type of remedy. When we talk about it, I'm going to say, never sign a construction contract or an architect agreement that does not have a waiver of consequential damages, meaning I don't care what happens in this project, you can't sue me for consequential damages. Demand as an architect always a waiver of consequential damages. Why do we do that? Well, consequential damages are indirect. They are remotely caused by the breach. They must be reasonably foreseeable, but they are remotely caused by the breach. Well, what's that? Well, that casino that I talked about earlier, the value of the lost revenue from the slot machines alone was close to, at that period of time, $6 to $7 million. But that has nothing to do with the construction of the building. So they were not, if we had a liquidated damage clause, which is the event line, the liquidated damage clause entitled us to get $1 million a day if we own. But let's say the contract was silent on these types of damages. If the casino didn't open on September 1st, I couldn't sue them for losing $6 to $7 million a day because it's a consequence of them not doing their work. I can sue them for how much it would cost to accelerate the work to get it done faster. Bring in 10 more crews or do this. Anything to do the work that's directly related to the construction. But the casino revenue is indirect. Another example, staying close to what you guys have, or maybe an example. So I hire you as my architect and you're going to design for me a factory. Candy factory. And I say to you that I'm going to need you on the candy factory. It's going to take, you put together a schedule, my contract put together a schedule, it's going to be about 27 months. And I want your A-team on board the whole 27 months. And we get bad weather, then there's some other things that happen, blah, 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 blah. And the project takes 32 months. So that's 5 months you had to have your A-team still working for. You did that, we paid you for your services. It's not like you had to do it for free. You got extra money for each month your team was there. So that wasn't the issue. But you're going to come back to me and you're going to say, I lost another giant candy factory project because I couldn't go out and bid it. Because you were holding on to my A-team. I lost an M&M Bars contract just down the road. And as a result of that, I lost a $30 million commission. You can't sue me for that if there's a waiver of consequential damages that has nothing to do with my project. It is a consequence of my project. But if we have a waiver of consequential damages, you can't sue me for that. But if you didn't, you could make the argument. I lost another project. I lost a project. That's a consequence. It's the cover damages that are the consequence of the breach, but that are not identified in the original agreement. Lost profit, loss of business. Those are the two things that we're trying. I lost business for the casino. I lost the profit that I would have made on the next project. It's often disclaimed in construction contracts, that waiver of construction damages. Always have a waiver. And the contractor should have too. It should be a mutual waiver. Everybody should be waiving everything. We don't want to have to do it and build that up. It's just, it's so hard. It's even harder to define what a really consequential waiver is. It's a fine. If that wastewater treatment system is causing you, the owner, to have fines because it's not operating properly, is that a consequential waiver? That's why we don't like the waiver. Liquidated damages. If a per day value normally, sometimes you can do it per week, but mostly per day, where actual damages later would be difficult to calculate. Even though the casino knew, based on their history and everything else, it was the first casino in kind in New Orleans, way back when they put it in. They just changed the laws to allow gambling. And so they knew generally what the value of the revenue was going to be, but they weren't sure, and so they were telling us, like I said, 6-7 million. But the contractor, and knowing the, how much money they were going to make on the project, would never pay that. So we were able to negotiate $1 million a day as a liquidity damage. Now you say, well, that sounds like a penalty. They're late. They have to pay $1 million a day. Well, the clause specifically, the liquidated damages, says this is not a penalty. This is a negotiation between the parties as to what the value of what the damages could be. What it basically is an agreement between the parties in the beginning that says, I, contractor, don't want the risk of having to pay those actual damages if I'm late. That's $6 to $7 million a day. And I, owner, don't want to fight about that consequential damage, but I guess should get something. So at the beginning, the very beginning of the contract, we've agreed on this number, $1 million. It may not cover me, may not make me whole, but it's hard to calculate now. Until we open the doors and see the people coming in and how many times the one arm band is pulled, we really won't know our risk. So we decided early. You're going to see it in lots of things. You're going to see it in, like, when you're building a condo building and the sale of a condo is how you calculate it. A residential, like an apartment building, what's your revenue coming in from an apartment? It could even be a homeowner. Like I had a project for a homeowner out in they were gut rehabbing a 4-story walk up in New York City, and they needed it done by a certain period of time because they had a lease on the house they were living in, and the lease was going to be over, and if they didn't get into the new space that they had were going to own, they would have to rent another place. So we entered into a liquidated damage provision of how much it would cost them for moving expenses and renting and doing all the other stuff if they didn't get the facility, or the house finished before. So you can even have it for little things as rental. Questions on liquidated damage? Yes. Yeah. That's a great question. Consequential damages are often resolved by a liquidated damage clause. So what you're saying is, so if you have consequential damages, it could be that I have to pay rent. It could be that I have to pay fines, all these other things. And we know that you can in some states, by the way, there's some states that you can't recover consequential damages. Like in Pennsylvania, they have a statute that says nobody can recover consequential damages. Most of you can track for it. So it is, consequential damages is indirect. How then do you make the party whole if I know that you're late, I'm going to lose $6 to $7 million a day? Or I work on a lot of power plants, and how much revenue I'm going to lose from energy. So I, as the owner, say, okay, fine, we're going to enter a contract, and I'm going to come after you for actual damages. And the contract is like, I can't handle $7 million a day. I will never contract with you. So now you have a situation where you have an owner that's going to have losses that are consequential, and no contractor is ever going to build that building. So we resolve that by creating this concept called liquidated damage. In the very beginning, we're going to write a clause into the contract that says, for every day you're late, you're going to pay me $1 million, or $500,000, or these people that their house was in, it was $2,000 a day. So it could be, you know, that from $2,000 to $1 million is huge. But instead of the unknowns and having to go through the lawsuits and everything later about what those unknowns are and everything else, we agree in the beginning to liquidated damages to cover potential consequences. Make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Punitive damages, legal fees, and costs. So, punitive damages are almost never awarded to breach of contract. I talked about that earlier. They're similar to paying, you can, punitive damages, you might think about it as a criminal fine, however, paying to the other party in the contract and not to the state. That's a punitive damage. So if there's fraud, they're going to potentially issue punitive damages against somebody. There can be statutes. So, like, in copyright infringement, here's an interesting thing. There's what's called treble damages, which means three times the value. So, like, if somebody's infringing, let's say I have a poster and I'm selling the poster and I have revenue of $5,000 a month, and then you steal my poster and are selling it and you sell it for 3 months, and so I could say I lost $15,000 of sales. I'm making this very basic. My sales were to zero because you were underselling me and everything else. So I am owed, because of your infringement, actual damage is the $15,000 for those 3 months that you were stealing from me. You were taking my drawing or my poster and selling it. They will, under the statute for copyright, allow you to get treble damages, triple. So I could get $45,000. And that is punitive because I only lost $15,000. But the statute allows it to go to the state. So it doesn't go to the state, it goes to the state. So sometimes the statute will allow you, sometimes it's the action of the party's fraud, depending. But generally, you don't have punitive damages. You just don't. The best we can do is the liquidated damages. Legal fees and costs. Legal fees that is not talked about in the agreement. Legal fees are not awarded. You must have it written into the agreement. So, generally not awarded in a breach of contract action, only if it's written into a contract, and only if it's reasonable allowed. Sometimes legal fees may be too high in the state or whatever, and the court can say what's reasonable. I had a very big case that was a trial, and we had, I think, legal fees for the trial alone, just the trial alone, was like $700,000. And we won, and we had a legal fee clause in the contract, and the court gave us $200,000. Because they were like, you guys charge too much. That's what the judge thought. But they said what was reasonable. So they, in this case, they were both the client, prior to that, and prior to law. So they gave us money, they awarded money for us, but it wasn't as much as they were. Okay. We're almost done. Mitigation is our last one. Mitigation of damages. So what happens if, can you, and this goes to your question about, can I go ahead as the injured party and have my role with my Mercedes design versus that? Well, I'm, as the injured party, required to mitigate my damages. I can't take advantage of either side. So the innocent party, the injured party, has to act reasonably. A breach by one party does not guarantee recovery of protection for anybody who does. You are not guaranteed anything. If the proof is case, you still have to be reasonable. The non-breaching party must take steps to minimize the total damage. So I had a project that was an ethanol factory that was out, way out in western Wisconsin. And there was problems, the steel had been arrived, it was delivered, there was problems with the contractor, blah, blah, blah. We ended up terminating the contractor. We were legally allowed to terminate the contractor. They were delayed. There was lots of things that we were seeking. We were seeking expectation damages and reliance damages. And part of the expectation damages, my client was claiming, and this is after we were hired, this all took place, before we were hired, was the cost to buy new steel. Because all the steel that had been delivered to the site had rusted. Well, when we fired the contractor, when my client fired the contractor, the steel was not rusted. My client had an obligation to cover and protect that steel from the elements, so it wouldn't rust, but they left it out. So I had to tell my client, we're happy about this, I'm like, you're not going to get the full value of that. You may get the value if you sell it for scrap, but you let it rot. You didn't mitigate your damages. So, it can be significant in construction cases. This is a multi-million-dollar element of our plans with the steel. And I was like, because we were hired well after all this happened. So we're coming in because I think when they've already gone south. But that's why I tell my clients, call me before. But they were brand new clients, so they found us after the fact. But that's what you want to do. You want to protect yourself. And again, you can't take advantage of it. That's a good question. If there's usually multiple bids, I don't know if we could make that argument. I mean, like, I write into my construction contract as an owner, the one I was drafting last night, there's a provision about subcontractors in the AIA form. I'll show it to you in the second part of the semester. It talks about subcontractors. I added a provision that says the contractor must go out to 3 subs to bid each trade. So you've got to go to 3 electricians, 3 carpenters, and everything else. So if I entered into an agreement with the new contractor after I fired the old one, if I didn't include that clause in there, then I could be considered not mitigating the damages. But do I have to go to 3 general contractors? Maybe not. If I go to a general contractor, because there's a timing, bidding, it takes time. So the court will look at this and say, we need to keep this project going because we had deadlines we had to meet down the way. So what was more expensive, to let the project linger, because the longer it takes for us to get it finished, the more damages we're going to potentially see, versus we've got a guy or a girl or whatever the contractor is that is the better, is an equal contractor. So it may. That may be an argument for general contractor, but it may not. So. Anything else? All right, that's it. So, thank you for doing it. And I have a good day.